Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
Fellow nationalists, I'd like to start by thanking all of you for the wonderful effort that you've made to get here this afternoon. We've had no end of inconvenience. We have been bounced from pillar to post. Some of us have not attended this meeting in the greatest of comfort, which we would have done if we'd had our first occasion. But most of you made it. And I'd like to thank you all for bearing with us in the great difficulties that we've had this afternoon. But I swore to the interviewers back at Friend's house, I said, we are going to have our meeting. Because I know our people, and I know that you will not be stopped from having your meeting. So thanks again for all the effort that you've made. Now, my colleagues have given you a picture of the tremendous development of the BNP in 1990. This attendance here is an indication of this. It is the biggest rally we've ever had. I've counted over 300 here, and no doubt we lost a few more on the way here who couldn't make it from Euston Road. That's just one indication. There are others that have been pointed out. The amount of television coverage we've had in the last few months, more than we had in the previous 7 or 8 years. The increase in new members that we've seen coming in, the increase in inquiries about the party, and of course, the tremendous votes achieved by Ken Walsh, by Steve Smith, and others in these recent elections. I know that it's a long way from where we have to go if we're to win. But when you compare it with what was being achieved by nationalist candidates in elections only a year or two previously, you get an idea of how far we've come. Now why? Why this upsurge? Because remember that for many years we were having our meetings and we were having about the same numbers there. We had about the same numbers joining as we had leaving. For many years we were just marking time and holding our own. We had this sudden upsurge, growing interest in our message. Why? Well, you know, sometimes it's a good thing to step back for a moment from daily and weekly affairs and to look at a phrase which I think has been used before this afternoon, to look at the big picture. Now, we have to talk about the past. Some people say let's forget the past, but we have to understand the past in order to understand why we are where we are today. So it is a good thing, I think, to look back over the past 50 years or so of the development, or we might say the atrophy of this country, to know why we have the kind of rulers now that we have, and we have the kind of policies imposed upon us that we have. We have to look back at it. Only last month, we had the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. And just to make sure we didn't forget the occasion, they brought out the film Battle of Britain, which I've always thought was one of the best films, because the propaganda in it was about 25% instead of being 95%, which it is in most war films. Not too much propaganda. And this film you saw all these continual shocks of one moment, a Messerschmitt 109 with a fair-skinned young pilot going down to his death. And the next moment, a shot of a Spitfire with an equally fair-skinned young man inside going down to his death. And looking at that, one was struck by the tragedy of it all. A criminal tragedy of that loss of life. The best of Europe dying. For what? For what? Now, going 5 years on from the Battle of Britain, we have the Allied victory of 1945. Victory, we might say, in inverted commas. Now, it's worth recalling this. The three main victorious powers, who were they? Britain, with her empire, and we had an empire then. The United States and Soviet Russia. The three main victorious powers. And the two main defeated powers. Germany, from whom we're happy to have our friends today, this afternoon, and Japan. They were the leading defeated powers. Then we come forward and we look at the world today. The world in 1990. Who are today the most growing, the most successful nations in the world today? Germany and Japan. The two very countries who were supposedly defeated in 1945. And then we come to look at how the victors are doing. Britain, America, Soviet Russia. Soviet Russia falling apart. The communist system collapsing. National bankruptcy. They can't even organize to get bread in the shops. From the country that has the greatest breadbasket of the world. The various constituent republics breaking away, the Soviet Union falling to pieces. Then we look across at America, and we see President Bush trying to grapple frantically with bankruptcy. America, the wealthiest country in the world, near bankruptcy. And again, torn apart by internal strife, racked by crime, we see America, the one-time giant, in ruins. And I don't have to tell you the state of the other victor, Britain. I don't have to tell you our condition. Now, that is surely an interesting historical fact. You have the three victors of 1945 all on their knees. All in ruins. You have the two defeated countries going up, strong, prosperous, beating the world in trade and in so many other things. To me, there is surely something significant in that fact. But doesn't it show that something terribly wrong has been going on in our country since 1945? We have the victory of democracy on the one hand and communism on the other hand. Despite this victory, where is communism and where is democracy today? I ought to paraphrase Mr., later Sir Winston Churchill, when he said, "Never has so much been heard by so many to so few." I want to say, can there be any parallel in the history of human conflict whereby victory was turned so rapidly into defeat? Can there be any parallel to that? Now, last week, I was asked by a TV interviewer, what makes you think that the people will turn to you? What makes me believe, what makes me certain that the people will turn to us is that in the end, in the catastrophe to which we are heading, they will be able to turn to no one else. They will have nowhere else to turn. Because it's abundantly clear that 45 years after that so-called victory of 1945, the governing powers of this country have fouled everything up. They have failed all the way down the line. They have fouled up everything. In 1945, they inherited a situation of victory. And since that time, they have turned that victory into total defeat. In that 45 years, they lost an empire. They've almost destroyed the industrial system of what was once the workshop of the world. They've proved again and again and again that they're totally incapable of developing a workable system of education. They've brought us to national bankruptcy. They've totally lost control of law and order. They've abandoned the streets. And they've given up vast areas of our once proud and happy land to a foreign invasion. The very foreign invasion that sends our young men of 1940 into the skies of Southern England to fight off. What a record! Look at the festering slums. Look behind the slums then for the mugger, the rapist, and the murderer who rule the streets at night, streets that have been abandoned by a power that has lost the will to govern. Look at the railways that give lousy service at enormous prices. Now, I don't often travel by train, but I travelled by train up to the dinner in London last night. And when I saw somebody on that train who looked as if they might have been a foreign visitor, I almost hung my head in shame at the filthy state of our railway system. Windows that hadn't been washed for weeks, maybe months. Litter all over the floor, filth and garbage and untidiness. And not only this, they're now charging us higher prices for railway travel than ever before. Look everywhere in the dirt and litter. Look at the schools, everywhere in the universities, turning out legions of ignoramuses, a labor force only fit to be the serfs of the world. Look at our roads, clogged up with the motor vehicles of Germany and Japan, the very people that we were supposed to have defeated 45 years ago. Look at our offices, brimful of machinery made in the Far East. Well, we pay millions of British working men and women to sit idle while our foreigner competitors just send their goods in by the bucketload every day. And everywhere you look, you see the symptoms of a disintegrating society. You see family life collapsing. You see divorce breaking out everywhere. You see illegitimacy going through the roof. And what do you see the church doing about all this? What are the clergy doing? The clergy are shuffling through the streets, demonstrating against apartheid. And you see them touting the collection boxes around on behalf of the hungry, of the Sudan or Ethiopia, while old folk are going hungry and going cold in the winter in Britain. Against the menace of racism. Racism again. Again as in government. You see the abdication of responsibility. You see a horde of little careerists and time servers desperately trying to jump into line with the trend of the moment. And these people, the people of the clergy, they are the ones who scream about the evils of racism. While society is collapsing around them, while the moral order is collapsing around them, these are the people who set themselves up as the leaders of a great crusade of moral righteousness against the white South Africans today, and tomorrow against the wicked racists of the BNP in Britain. These people who parade as the keepers of our moral conscience when they can spare the time from chasing choir boys. The year is pantomime in which the boys and girls of the old gang of politics pirouette and posture, scream and screech at each other in front of the TV cameras while Great Britain falls further and further to pieces. Each one of them comes on the stage and delivers the familiar whine that we've all heard a thousand times over. Year in, year out, that all the troubles of Britain are the fault of their opponents. And if only the people of this country, in their infinite patience, if only the people of this country would give them one more try, everything would come right. Mrs. Thatcher's message to the Tory conference yesterday was, "We are doing well." Well, I don't know where Mrs. Thatcher has been, whether she's been on Mars or Saturn, but I've been here and they've been doing terrible for 11 years! The all well played out rigmarole of the party game. Give them one more try and everything will come right. Very good is for all the elect. Something for every faction and every interest. A massive game of bribery and corruption. All designed to appeal to every greedy instinct, every selfish whim. And the name that they give to this great big charade of parliament, of party conferences and the rest of it, and elections and the rest of it. What is the name they give to it? They call it democracy. And they try to tell us that their precious democracy is the most wonderful and enlightened system of government ever devised by the brain of man. But let us look at what their democracy has achieved. Let us look at the skilled worker in the prime of life, wanting to do a useful job, but condemned to idleness because finance can make better profits out of the factories of Hong Kong and Korea. What has democracy done for him?
Welcome to Voice of Albion, John Tyndall, Part 10. First you heard the first half of a speech of John Tyndall speaking at a well-attended BNP meeting in 1990. John Tyndall had been leader of the BNP since its formation in 1982. Now, the 11th hour, chapter 12, The Role of the Media. John Tyndall writes, "We British are brought up to regard our press, broadcasting services and other organs of public opinion as being different from those of totalitarian, in quotes, countries, insofar as the latter exists to promote one single point of view. The reality is that this picture is grossly misleading. It would be much more accurate to say that in Britain, the media constitute a state within the state, or perhaps more accurately, a state above the state, so that the question of whether they are independent of the existing government of the day is really an irrelevant one. Let us take, to begin with, the BBC, the sole body with influence over public opinion that anyone tries to claim is publicly owned, i.e. not in private hands. The theory has it that this corporation is not state-controlled. That, in fact, is legally not the case. The board of governors that presides over all the affairs of the corporation is appointed by the government of the day and can be dismissed by the government of the day, and is therefore within the control of any government that wishes to exercise control. Even if this were not so, however, and the BBC were generally outside any such government control as manifest in this power of appointment, where would that leave us? JT asks. It would leave us with a vast and all-pervasive institution with power over millions of minds that was responsible to nobody. Just why should the people presiding over that institution have such special privileges that are not enjoyed by anyone else in the population? They are not elected by the people. The people have not the slightest say in the composition of the programmes that are put out under their authority. So the presentation of the BBC to the public as some sort of body constituted in accordance with the principles of democracy is sheer humbug. JT points out that the BBC is in fact no more responsible to the people and no more within the power of the people to regulate or restrain than the officially state-controlled broadcasting services were in Soviet Russia. A quick comment there. I'm not sure if citizens had to pay for the privilege in Soviet Russia, but we in the UK have to pay for a TV licence by law. I've dodged it many years. I've never paid it by choice, but I did get caught one year at a property. I was supposed to go to court for not having a TV licence. I did intend to go to court and argue, but I never went. And then some bailiffs come, and then there was a clamp on my car on the wheel. And they did have the power from the magistrate to remove my car and sell it. So I had to ring family and arrange to pay the TV licence, the court fees and the bailiff fees all in one go to get that clamp off. That's the situation with the BBC TV licence. JT continues, the reality is that both members of the government of whatever ruling party and governors of the BBC belong to the same club of well-vetted establishment servants who can be thoroughly relied upon to uphold all the standard politically correct values. They are men and women of the same basic outlook, notwithstanding that they may have differing political party allegiances and may take different stands on some of the public issues. We therefore have a situation in which the government, in a loose kind of way, has control over the BBC Board of Governors, who in turn have control over programme producers, and therefore over the content of programmes, which in effect means that they regulate the political climate within which work both government and opposition, thus completing a circle of mutual patronage that may be likened to a merry-go-round, rotating on axes but always ends up in the same place. Independent TV and radio, on the other hand, serve, by their very names, to sustain the illusion that there is some kind of alternative choice to the viewers who get tired of tuning into the BBC. So there is, as long as we are talking about variations in the non-stop diet of daily drivel, consisting of soap operas, chat shows, parlour games, third-rate movies and pop music. When, however, it comes to choice over the truth or the mentals, i.e. the basic cultural and political norms and values that these programmes represent, there is no real choice at all. Another quick comment. These days in Britain, the two main cable and satellite TV providers are Virgin, owned by Richard Branson, who is a multiculturalist, and secondly, Rupert Murdoch's Sky Network, Murdoch being a Zionist and multiculturalist. There is, for example, very little difference between the BBC's 24-hour news channel and Sky's 24-hour news channel. JT writes, for there is a definite limit to the independence of the independents. The various private TV and radio companies, like the newspapers, cannot survive without advertisements and, as stated in a previous chapter, when mention was made of the press, any close-knit community commanding a sizeable proportion of advertising contracts can hold the whip hand of independent broadcasters, in the sense of being able to veto the programmes, or parts thereof, that they deem threatening to their interests. JT quotes a Daily Telegraph columnist called Peter Simple, when in some personal memoirs of a period when he worked in broadcasting, he said that voicing a non-socialist thought in BBC circles was like blaspheming in church. What we are really speaking of here, JT goes on, is an overwhelming consensus of minds and spirits favourable to the leftist liberal world outlook. With its concomitant loyalties towards internationalism and multiracialism, and its aversion to anything suggestive of informed and intelligent patriotic sentiment. The true reality is that the whole of our broadcasting services are firmly under the control of those committed to this one-worlder liberal consensus, though only in the sense that the same establishment controls nearly every other nerve centre of British life. For instance, with the universities and other places of higher education dominated by the same forces, it is a mathematical certainty that a very large portion, if not all, of the graduates applying for jobs in broadcasting are likely to be people of a similar way of thinking to the leftist, liberal, internationalist complexion of broadcasting is therefore that of the press, largely self-regulating. We need be no doubt, however, that should anyone harbouring different sentiments think of trying to get into this inner sanctum, the vetting procedure employed with all applicants is likely to ensure his failure. JT recalls that he and his associates occasionally talked and had correspondence with people who work merely as cameramen and technicians with the broadcasting networks, in other words, having no influence whatever on the content of broadcast material, and they have testified again and again that if their employees knew they even had this loose contact with us, they would instantly be fired. JT contrasts our liberal internationalist establishment with that of Soviet Russia or the media of Nazi Germany controlled by the ministry of the late Dr. Goebbels. Only the structure and methods are different. Whereas the latter two regimes were comparatively open and frank in their acknowledgement of their regulation of these amenities, never making any bones about the fact that they were there to be used for the defence of the established state ideology, our own system of public mind control is shrouded in a haze of hypocrisy and soothing jargon designed to maintain the pretense that it is free. In order to make the pretense credible, it is necessary to preserve some element of controversy in the presentation of current affairs programmes. This is easily done by selecting the debates so as to limit them to safe, in quotes, issues on which our masters can, from the graciousness of their hearts, happily permit more than one viewpoint to the voiced, without the slightest danger that any of the real sacred cows will even so much as be exposed to discussion, let alone violated. At the same time, great care is taken to invite to these debates only people who can, by reputation, be relied upon to steer clear of all the supreme taboos and heresies. JT gives the example of Question Time, the main weekly debating show in Britain. I'm sure most listeners saw the BNP leader Nick Griffin on Question Time, so you know how that works. I do know someone who personally went on Question Time, a BNP activist, and he told us that all the questions, if you want to ask a question, it's scripted, it's vetted. So this kind of pretense that people are asking questions off the cuff is completely false, and it's also filmed sort of ahead of time so it can later be edited just in case someone may get out a question which is unpalatable. Exactly the same type of rigged debate takes place whenever there has been a major race riot in one of our inner cities, JT adds. To excuse such a discussion completely might be revealing more about the BBC's bias than it wants to reveal. So the discussion is allowed but carefully steered in a direction whereby the argument is between two different points of view as to how we can make the multiracial society work. Strictly forbidden is any point of view to the effect that multiracial society itself might not be a good thing and that we should consider putting an end to it. Such a suggestion is excluded because, of course, it represents a central issue involved in the racial controversy. another quick comment. During and just after the 2011 riots, the BBC made massive attempts to portray the rioters as white as well as black. The truth was at least 95-97%, something like that, was black. You could easily see that. But the BBC tried to get it as near as possible to 50-50. There was a kind of a mini riot on the third day, I think, in Salford, which is up north, which was mostly whites, and this was seized upon big time. You know, they showed it all the time, just to make the point that the rioters was all races, but that riot was clearly started by blacks, and they was the main people doing it, as they do. JT then illustrates the mentality of those who control the news by speaking about South Africa. During the emergency in South Africa in 1986, the news media became totally obsessed with events there, reporting all the troubles with a blatant bias and selectively and always in such a way as to show the South African government and security forces in the most unfavourable light. In many evening bulletins, the issue occupied the first 5 to 10 minutes coverage, leading one to wonder whether in fact anything had happened in Britain that day that was of the slightest public interest. Of course it had. But here again, another aspect of the propaganda technique of the broadcasters was being demonstrated. This is the technique of choosing the order of importance and priority of news items in a manner which bears no relation whatever to their true and correct order. Focusing upon some disturbance in a far-off country, of course, has the very convenient effect of taking people's minds off troubles much nearer to home, and of much greater consequence to themselves. Sometimes, indeed, items of news of importance in Britain are not given just less than their due attention. They are excluded completely. This technique is not new, JT states. He then quotes from Spengler's Decline of the West. And the other side of this belated freedom, it is determined to everyone to say what he pleases, permitted to everyone to say what he pleases, but the press is free to take notice of what he says or not. It can condemn any truth to death simply by not undertaking its communication to the world. A terrible censorship of silence, which is all the more potent in that the masses of newspaper readers are absolutely unaware it exists. JT continues, many other types of programming are fair game for the brainwashers who just cannot keep their fingers out of anything. Full-length feature films consist, in no small part, of imports from Hollywood, mostly for really second-rate. Hollywood has, of course, been an almost exclusively Jewish preserve for a long time, and the contents of its products very much reflect the ethnic bias of its producers. JT then points out the disparity between the hundreds of German World War II films out of Hollywood, which paint the Nazis as the bad guys, while films portraying communism as a brutal and unpleasant regime, are very far between. Why is it, might be asked, is Hollywood so soft on communism, while obsessed, 5 decades on, with National Socialism? Perhaps the late Senator McCarthy, were alive today, might have been able to supply the answer. The Senator, of course, will be known for his courageous investigations of the 1950s, which showed that Hollywood was riddled with communists and fellow travellers. It still is today, having survived, with the help from some strange and esoteric forces, the expulsions of the McCarthy era. Communism is not, as a general rule, shown as anything more than a limited evil when it's shown as evil at all. Because communism and the film industry are on the same side, for his efforts to point this out, the American public, McCarthy has ever since been reviled by the industry and by the media generally, both in America and over here, as a figure of horror on a par with the German monsters of 1939-45. JT states, if there is one thing that the czars of the media are determined to crush, it is the spirit of awakened nationalism and rage consciousness. For the national spirit to be crushed, one important tactic is to make people ashamed of their national history, and in the case of the British people, this must be, of course, include imperial history. JT gives the example of the 1980s film Gandhi by Richard Attenborough. Gandhi glorified the Indian resistance to British rule Nationalism is only out of order if it is white nationalism. Coloured nationalism is quite acceptable. While depicting India's British colonial overlords as a combination of brutality and cretinism, with a partial, vicious and defamatory, and factually untrue, portrayal of that fine soldier and patriot, General Dyer. Another example JT gives is the Rhodes series, shown in 1996, in which the great empire builder was portrayed as a combination of megalomaniac and homosexual, the latter assumption being based on the flimsy evidence that he died a bachelor at 49, and as might have been expected in the pioneer environment, enjoyed strong male companionship. These films are merely two of hundreds of perhaps thousands of their kind to be produced on the never-halting conveyor belt of propaganda, showpieces of the silver screen aimed at undermining the white race and the great nations which it is comprised. Day in, day out, through the use of television, radio, pop concerts, the record business, films, newspapers, magazines, books and video, this vast industry works to obtain a monopoly over our brains and our emotions, and all with an object that should be apparent to any rational observer, to bring about the degeneration of Western mankind. JT then discusses British newspapers and concludes, it defends the established superstitions of politics with all the bigotry and intolerance of a medieval priesthood. It steadfastly refuses to permit a word to be uttered in suggestion of the idea that conspiracy is at work in national and international affairs. It imposes a rigid censorship on news reflecting the political role of international finance. It regards articles supporting any kind of genuine nationalism, political or economic, as tantamount to sedition. It outlaws critical comment of any racial group, except of course white British. It particularly prohibits any in-depth examination of the activity of Zionist Jews. JT gives the example of when an article written in the Times on the 18th of February 1978, at that time he was leader of the National Front, the article commented on the then NF campaign in schools. Head teachers and teachers should be on their guard against allowing the Front any presence inside the schools. Such activities should not be tolerated. In general, school authorities should not see attempts at National Front recruitment in the same tolerant light as they regard the formation, say, of Labour or Conservative societies in schools. Then a little further on the article, he comments on the NF problem in holding meeting halls, saying, when the National Front wishes to hire a hall for a public meeting, there is nothing discreditable in taking into account the message it is likely to disseminate from that public platform before deciding whether or not to grant it permission to use the hall. Those local authorities or other bodies which have refused to allow the Front to use their facilities, because in conscience and after considering broad aspects of public policy, they have come to the conclusion that it would be contrary to public order and good race relations to permit the meeting, should not be the subject of reproach. JT comments, it will be observed that throughout all of these two quoted passages, there is an avoidance of crude language or any violent expressions, such as smash them. The overall message, however, amounts just to that, methods which in any other context the Times would dismiss as totalitarian, should, with perfect justification, be used to deny the voice of nationalism a public hearing. This is, JT reminds the reader, the press which purports to stand for the loftiest ideas of democracy and for the principle that all public issues of importance should be subjected to free and reasoned debate. Something of the same mentality with regard to the rights of nationalists to speak was displayed in a report in the Guardian newspaper on the 26th of April 1997, following the British National Party's party election broadcast in which JT took part and for which the BNP had qualified by putting up 55 candidates in the general election, which took place a few days later. I'll now play the BNP televised broadcast from 1997.
From the others. I'm not speaking to you to hand out bribes, to flatter and deceive, to promise everything to everyone. I'm asking you to help us undo the ruin that the old parties, Tory and Labour, have brought upon our country during this century. and to build a movement which in the coming century will put the great back into Britain. For 1,000 years, these shores have symbolized the identity of this nation and its freedom. Millions have died to defend them. In just 50 years, those millions have been betrayed. The floodgates have been opened. This is Britain in the 1990s.
Is this what our war heroes fought for? Is it the future that you want? For 1,000 years, our country stood on its own, proud, strong, and free. Not anymore. Tories and Labour have sold us out to Europe. A new flag flies over our land. Under that flag, foreigners make our laws. One government after another has allowed our industries to be destroyed. They've allowed Europe to ruin our fishermen. They've allowed cut-price goods to close down our factories. Britain today has become an industrial wasteland, while we import from abroad the goods we should be making ourselves. The result? Millions out of work. Young people doomed to spend their lives in idleness. This was once a law-abiding country. Not anymore. Crime is out of control. Almost every day brings news of another hideous murder. Yet society seems powerless against the criminal. Authority has gone soft.
A few years ago, a group of people decided they'd had enough of weak government, betrayal of the British people being sold down the river. They decided to do something. They formed the British National Party.
Now this party has branches all over Britain. Branches comprised of people very like you, campaigning in their neighbourhoods, offering the British people a new ideal to believe in.
The parties of Parliament are the parties of the old century, the century of British decline. For the new century, we need a new ideal. A new kind of politics. We need people in power with faith in the ability of Britain to stand on her own feet, build her own future. We must get out of Europe and become a free nation once again. We must rebuild British industry by buying British, not importing from abroad the goods we can produce ourselves. By recovering our manufacturing base, we'll provide millions of new jobs and at last give our young people hope for the future. We must stop immigration and we must help the immigrants return home. We need an all-out war against crime and terrorism, starting with a restoration of capital punishment. Above all, we need a government of strength, not weakness. A government that'll stand up for the interests of this country and put Britain and the British people first. Our party is fighting more than 50 seats in this election. If yours is one of them, I hope that you'll give us your vote.
For further information, please write to the British National Party, care of P.O. Box 117, Welling, Kent, DA163DW.
That was a party election broadcast by the British National Party. It can be seen again at 11:30 on BBC Two.
JT continues. The Guardian writer Mark Lawson was obviously enraged that we had been allowed on the air. Heading his report, A Pouring of Poison, he made it very obvious that he profoundly objected to my statement that we must stop immigration and we must help the immigrants to return home. Mr. Lawson mentioned a pro-life broadcast concerning abortion that had been screened shortly before and from which shots of a destroyed fetus had been excluded upon the BBC's insistence, and said controversial scenes in Thursday's pro-life alliance had been blacked out by the BBC, but nothing of Tyndall's poisonous address had been threatened with what he would presumably insist on calling whiting out. It seems confused culture in which a campaign broadcast is not allowed to show what does happen to fetuses, but a man is permitted to say what he would like to happen to non-white people. Channel 4 decided not to run the broadcast. Those who did run it might like to explain the reasoning by which viewers are protected from upsetting images, but exposed to fascist rhetoric. JT speaks about publishing in Britain and the enormous importance of book reviews in the literary pages of papers. He uses David Irving as an example. Irving was, for years, one of the best-selling authors, and his books were almost guaranteed good circulation and handsome profits for their publishers. But Irving, as time went on, was getting ever closer to the minefield awaiting those writers whose works displeased the ruling establishment. In Uprising, a book dealing with the Hungarian Revolt in 1956, Irving sent out certain danger signals by daring to point out that a large portion of the communist rulers against whom the insurgents had rebelled were Jewish. When he completed a later work, Churchill's War, which told many uncomfortable home truths about Britain's wartime prime minister, which contradicted the popular picture of him portrayed over the years by establishment writers and propagandists, he found that none of the well-established publishers would touch the book. Eventually, the book was published by a small, non-established publishing firm in Australia. When launched in Britain, it was subjected to the silent treatment by most of the media. We are here reminded again of Spengler's point about condemning truth to death. JT continues, free speech nowadays only means something if what is spoken is relayed to a large audience or while being reported in the papers or on TV or radio, for no one is going to influence the course of national politics unless what he says reaches the millions. Daily, the media feed the people with a diet of degeneracy combined with censored news and comment, all with the purpose of reducing them to a herd of cattle lacking either the wit or the will to resist the brave new world that their masters have planned for them, which world is now in an advanced stage of construction. Daily, there is the constant stream of poison directed to undermining all the finer human qualities that go to the building and preservation of successful nations. Along with non-stop political propaganda, in its direct and indirect forms, there is an unending avalanche of products encouraging moral and sexual license, homosexuality, and every other imaginable depravity and perversion. All the same methods are used to degenerate morality, manliness, loyalty, patriotism, pride of race, and the soldier qualities. A nation subject to this conditioning over the period of one or two generations becomes a nation ripe for conquest and enslavement, whether these are archived or achieved by military or political means. The media, JT asserts, are worth 100 divisions to any would-be enemy in war, so long as they are controlled and directed in the manner that operates in contemporary Britain. In conclusion to this chapter, JT writes, dealing with the mass media, there is one final thing left to be said. When all has been debated, when we are left with the truth that there is no higher right belonging to a nation and a people than the right of self-preservation, if the leadership of any people is faced with the existence of an influence within a national body that is serving as nothing short of a fifth column, eating about the very vitals of that body and promising with certainty to destroy it if not checked, then that leadership, by failing to root out that influence, is showing not moderation, restraint, tolerance or broad-mindedness, but sheer craven cowardice, irresponsibility and lack of will to govern. This is the principle upon which we must base our policy to rescue the mass media from the hands of the liars, subverters and corruptors who now control them, to restore them to the property of the nation to which they rightly belong. That's the end of chapter 12, The Role of the Mass Media. Chapter 13 is called Beyond Capitalism and Socialism. There is a postscript to chapter 12 that I'll read out. Postscript. After the original text of this chapter was written, but before it was submitted to the printer, an incident occurred which typified the outlook and behaviour of many operatives of today's mass media. One of the author's leading colleagues, Richard Edmonds, gave an interview to two journalists of the Sunday Times newspaper concerning a literature distribution project in which he had been engaged. The journalists, John Craig and Joe Revell, asked him before leaving to give them a telephone number at which they could contact him during weekdays in case any further matter arose in connection with the subject of the interview. When they requested this number, they undertook to treat it in strict confidence. Mr. Edmonds gave the two journalists his business number in good faith. Subsequently, they rang the number and ascertained, from the switchboard operator at the other end, the name of the company for which Mr. Edmonds worked. In their report in the Sunday Times the following weekend, they published the name of this company, though it had no relevance whatsoever to the matter being reported. The very next day, Mr. Edmonds was summoned to the office of his superior in the company and informed he would have to leave. Richard Edmonds was thus deprived of his livelihood because of this piece of spite and viciousness on the part of the two reporters. Because they did not like his politics, they decided that they would cause embarrassment to him in his job, in the hope that this he would be dismissed. They succeeded in their objective. Such are the practices of the free press, in quotes, which the British people are taught to regard as one of their most valued institutions. These are, of course, the tactics of the gutter, and it is at the level that the so-called quality newspapers operate, no less do their more crudely represented counterparts. This point has been made in the preceding chapter, and this story underlines it. I'll now play out with a short speech by David Jones at the 2012 John Tyndall Memorial Meeting. David is talking about an upcoming by-election he will be standing in as an independent. Dave helped the National Front candidate this year, who got over 11%. His strategy is to stand as an independent in a local ward in 2014, while helping the National Front candidate in a neighbouring ward. This nationalist cooperation is a good strategy, and will hopefully be utilised in other parts of the country in the local elections next year. Have a happy new year. See you next Sunday. 14 words.
So, the floor is yours. Keith, thank you very much for the introduction. Rochdale was mentioned about the Asian grooming scandals. That's what I would call a threat from without. That's an external threat to white people. This election, I'm in on October 25th, it's a town council by-election. I'm determined to take the fight to people who are destroying us from within, which is the liberal intelligentsia, the establishment, the organised gay lobby, all of whom are exclusively white, the charities who are all geared to politically correct aims, promoting multiculturalism. They all seem to have descended upon Todmorden and towns like it over the last few years, towns that are just on the edge of the larger towns, Rochdale, Burnley, that are taken over by the non-whites. It seems to me that the establishment moves into the smaller towns bordering them to stop them from becoming hostile to what their neighbouring towns are turning into. But they don't want the people of Todmorden looking at their place and seeing Rochdale, seeing their town like Rochdale 10 years' time. Now, this election is particularly interesting because the Labour Party have failed to put nomination papers in. The Conservative Party have failed to put nomination papers in. The Liberal Democrats are the only people that have come forward to stand. And the Liberal Democrat candidate is a son of a 3rd Ungarisch Waffen SS veteran. A repentant Nazi. Yes. Interestingly enough, even more than that, the next ward, there was going to be an election which only a Liberal Democrat contested. I could only contest one, so I picked Central. The next ward down, there's a Liberal Democrat fella called Baxter, the sole candidate, who is a former member of the AWB of South Africa. Believe it or not. Now, these people are coming forward to champion multiracialism, liberalism, democracy, gay rights, against little old me, the nationalist independent, fighting Central Ward in Todmorden. Now, what a sorry state has that come to in Todmorden? That we've got
people who obviously, and Steve Smith alluded to this earlier on when he talked about conservative politicians, you know, looking across at the sea of black faces they're speaking to and not meaning what they really mean it. Not what they really mean. They don't genuinely believe in the multiracialism, multiculturalism, etc. that they're preaching. These people don't believe in it either. Yet they're stepping forward to challenge people who do believe in nationalism, who do believe in patriotism, do believe in standing up for what's right for the British people, for the white people of this country. Now, I believe I have a very strong chance of winning this election, so I would pretty much like to put an appeal out now. If anybody lives near to Todmorden that's got next Sunday free, I would invite you to come to Todmorden to take part in the effort to unseat the Liberal Democrat Third Ungarish Waffen SS son. I'm going to challenge the Muslims by standing up for the gay rights Liberal Democrat Party against Dave Jones. Now, I believe that we've not won any elections for a while now in nationalism, and the longer it goes that we do win an election, the harder it's going to get for us, for definite. If it goes into 2013, we don't win an election. Goes into 2014, we don't win an election. We might as well just say goodbye to it, because, you know, we've got to turn this around. You know, in the eyes of the British people, that, you know, the media's convinced them that we're finished, they're forgetting about us. We've got to do something now, not just my election, but in any elections that you guys might be fighting. We've got to turn this around, and we've got to actually win a seat within the next year. If not my seat, another person's seat. So, county council elections are coming up next year. I don't know who's standing there. I'm willing to support any nationalist of any party that's willing to stand that I can get to and support. National Front, Democratic Nationalist, whoever, even the BPP, who I'm no longer a member of. We need to turn this around, and if anybody wants to come to Todmorden next Sunday to help me turn it around, please speak to me after the meeting, and hopefully we can take our first seat for nationalism.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.